Kids tuned to yesterday, delivering programs from radio's yesteryear. I'm your host, Mark Lipponier. In this hour, science fiction. Later on, it's X-1 from 1957. But first, a journalistic look at aliens, or flying saucers, in a program called The Case of the Flying Saucer, hosted by Edward R. Murrow. Listen now to the CBS broadcast from April 7th, 1950.
This is Edward R. Murrow. We're going to talk about flying saucers. We're going to talk about them from the standpoint of reporters, not as comedians, not as sensationalists. For the past 3 years, a large number of perfectly sane and reliable people have been involved in this flying saucer business. Even those of us who have never seen one have become involved. We read about them, talk about them, wonder about these reports of strange phenomena in the skies. So almost from the start, CBS has been following the story. We have been collecting material on flying saucer observations for many months, checking, cross-checking, trying to track down leads, no matter how far afield they took us. This, tonight, is our report. We frankly admit that we don't know whether flying saucers actually exist. We've never seen one. We are going to bring you the facts at hand. What they add up to? Well, that's for you to decide. That's up to you. It all began just a little less than three full years ago. It began in the sky over western Washington, up there in the hip pocket of the country. Early one June morning in 1947, a C-46 Marine transport with 32 Marines aboard crashed in the vicinity of Mount Rainier. An air search was immediately organized to locate the downed plane. Among the many service and private flyers who participated in this search was Mr. Kenneth Arnold, a businessman of Boise, Idaho, a veteran pilot in forest fire control work, a man with 6 years' experience flying over the rugged terrain in and around Mount Rainier. Yesterday morning, we spoke to Mr. Arnold over the phone. We asked him to repeat for us, in his own words, what he saw in the sky over Mount Rainier on June 24, 1947. We recorded what he said, and we're going to play it for you now. The slight beep that you will hear intermittently is required by law to let both parties of a phone conversation know they are being recorded. Here now is Mr. Kenneth Arnold.
It was while I was searching for this crash that I noticed a terrific blue flash pass nose of my airplane. I noticed that the flash came from a chain of very peculiar-looking objects that were rapidly approaching Mount Rainier at about 107 degrees. This chain of objects were nine in number. I assumed at the time they were a new formation or a new type of jet, though I was baffled by the fact that they did not have any tails. It passed almost directly in front of me, but at a distance of about 23 miles, which is not very great in the air. I judged their wingspan to be at 100 feet across. The sighting did not particularly disturb me at the time, except that I had never seen planes of that type.
Mr. Arnold, after landing, made a routine report of what he had seen to a Civil Aeronautics Administration representative, promptly forgot the matter, until the wheels of publicity began to turn. The floodgates opened.
I never could understand at that time why the world got so upset about this, as these things didn't seem to be a menace. I believe they had something to do with our Army and Air Force.
On three different occasions, Mr. Arnold was questioned by military intelligence. They expressed doubt as to the accuracy of some of his reported observations.
That's right. Now, of course, some of the reports they did take from newspapers, which did not quote me properly. Now, when I told the press, they misquoted me, and in the excitement of it all, one newspaper and another one got it so ensnarled up that nobody knew just exactly what they were talking about, I guess.
Here's how the name Flying Saucer was born.
These objects more or less fluttered like they were, I'd say, boats on very rough water or a very rough air of some type. And when I described how they flew, I said that they flew like you take a saucer and throw it across the water. Most of the newspapers misunderstood and misquoted that, too. They said that I said that they were saucer-like. I said they flew in a saucer-like fashion.
That was an historic misquote. While Mr. Arnold's original explanation has been forgotten, the term flying saucer has become a household word. Few people realize that Mr. Arnold has reported seeing these same strange objects in the sky on three other occasions. He says that some pilots in the Northwest have reported seeing them on eight separate occasions. We asked for his own personal opinion on the nature of what he and the others had seen.
I don't know how best to explain that. I more or less have reserved an opinion as to what I think. Naturally, being a natural-born American, if it's not made by our science or our Army Air Forces, I'm inclined to believe that it's of an extraterrestrial origin.
Extraterrestrial origin? You mean you think there's a possibility they may be coming out of space from other planets? I suppose that's pretty hard for people to take seriously.
Well, I'll tell you this much. All the airline pilots, none of us have appreciated being laughed at. We made our reports essentially to begin with because we thought that if our government didn't know what it was only our duty to report it to our nation and to our Air Force out of it. I think it's something that is of concern to every person in the country. And I don't think it's anything for people to get hysterical about. Now, that's just my frank opinion of it.
So that's how it all began. That was the trigger action. Kenneth Arnold's story went scudding over the news wires. Radio and newspapers picked it up. And then within days, the country broke out into a flood of flying saucer observations. Many of these reports, a great many of them, obviously could be discounted. Others, reports from perfectly competent, sober, and reliable observers, found no easy answer. In the face of this, late in 1947, the Chief of Staff of the Air Forces, at that time General Carl Tui Spots, sent a directive to the Air Materiel Command, located at Wright Field, Ohio.
The Air Materiel Command is directed to set up a project whose purpose is to collect, collate, evaluate, and distribute to interested government agencies and contractors all pertinent information concerning sightings of phenomena in the atmosphere, which can be construed to be of concern to the national security.
So was born
between 300 and 400 miles per hour.
Remember, these were trained observers, Air Force men.
The objects reportedly traveled in a straight line, taking the mean reported speed, 350 miles per hour, and the time in sight, 1/2 hour. The objects must then have traveled 175 miles while in sight. If the objects were of such proportions as to be seen at that distance, it is believed that more details could have been observed at the first sighting.
And the Air Materiel Command opinion on the Muroc Air Base sightings was this.
This report is a result of misinterpretation of the nature of real stimuli, probably research balloons.
Another report on January 7th, 1948. Tech Sergeant Quinton A. Blackwell, chief operator of the control tower at Godman Field, an Air Force base at Fort Knox, Kentucky, spotted a strange object hovering over the south portion of the field. In a matter of minutes, a flight of four P-51 fighter planes approaching the field were contacted by radio and asked to chase the object. Leader of the flight was Captain Thomas F. Mantell, Jr., a veteran of the Normandy invasion with some 3,000 flying hours to his credit. At 2:45, Mantell reported by radio.
Object directly ahead and above and moving about half my speed. Going up to take a look.
At 3:15, Mantell reported again.
Object still ahead and above, moving at about my speed or faster, 360 miles per hour. The thing looks metallic and is of tremendous size. I'm trying to close in for a better look.
By now, Mantell and his flight were at about 15,000 feet. They had no oxygen equipment. At 18,000 feet, the escorting planes turned back, but Mantell kept climbing. His next report came from 20,000 feet.
Going to 25,000. If no closer, we'll abandon search.
That was the last report from Captain Thomas Mantell. At approximately 25,000 feet, it is believed he blacked out for want of oxygen. His plane climbed another 5,000 feet and then went into a dive. When it crashed, parts of it were scattered around an area covering 1/6 of a mile. Project Saucer's conclusion.
It seems probable that the object observed was the planet Venus.
Later, in a report dated April 27th, 1949, this conclusion was reversed. Further investigation showed the elevation and azimuth readings of Venus, and the object, as reported at specified time intervals, just didn't jibe. The object Captain Mantell chased to his tragic death is now officially marked
unidentified.
In all, Project Saucer investigated 375 cases. The report takes in 244 different observations. Just yesterday, we asked Major General William F. McKee, Assistant Vice Chief of Staff, United States Air Forces, to summarize the conclusions reached by Project Saucer. He said,
"During 2 years of thorough investigation, no evidence was found which would indicate that the reported flying saucers were anything but the result of natural phenomena. On the other hand, all the evidence indicated that the reports of unidentified flying objects could be accounted for under three major headings. 1, misinterpretation of various conventional objects. 2, a mild form of hysteria. 3, or simple hoaxes. It has been suggested that what people actually have been seeing is the result of some of our own secret experiments, guided missiles or new types of planes or flying weapons. This is emphatically not the case. None of the three military departments nor any other agency in government is conducting experiments, classified or otherwise, with disc-shaped flying objects which could be a basis for the reported phenomena."
On December 27, 1949, Project Saucer went out of existence. The flying saucers, however, refused to follow the project into limbo. Just possibly one of the reasons behind the stubbornness of the saucers to accept the mantle of oblivion was an article that appeared in True magazine just about the time Project Saucer was abandoned. It had previously been shown pretty conclusively that the number of sighting reports over a period of months usually followed closely the amount of publicity given to flying saucer observations. A lot of stories, a lot of sightings. Few stories, few sightings. Psychologists call this mass suggestion. But to return to the True magazine article printed in December of 1949. Some percentage of the new wave of flying saucer reports can certainly be chalked off to mass suggestion. But again, as in the first reports, there remained that same unexplained percentage of reliable, trained observers who claim to have seen some object or objects wheeling, whirling, zooming, slicing, or hovering in the sky. Douglas Gourley of Laguna Beach, California, is an example. Here's his story.
I served 14 months as an anti-aircraft observer with a searchlight battery, and also 18 months as a seacoast and anti-aircraft observer with another searchlight battery. I was driving north March 21st on 101 Highway at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, when my attention was distracted by the sunlight reflecting off of some objects. I counted 8 of them, proceeding directly out to sea at 2,000 feet altitude. They gave the appearance of being made out of aluminum, and I could observe a perfect circle outline of these craft. They were going, I would say, approximately 150 miles an hour. They were definitely a powered craft of some sort.
Now here's a report from Selma, Alabama.
We were riding along the open country and had been observing a very beautiful sunset. And as the sun dipped over the western horizon, I looked to my right. And there in the sky were three small lights, which to me appeared to be three very small clouds. I looked steadily and I said, "No, they are not clouds, they are airplanes." Then I called my husband's attention to it, and he said, "No, those are not airplanes, they are lights." And we observed them very closely. But being in motion ourselves, to us they were motionless, because we didn't stop. But as we rode along, for something over a mile, they hung there in the sky, and they were, to us, had the appearance of tubes of fluorescent light, a beautiful, silvery, pink-tinged moonlight. And I said to my husband, "That gives me a feeling that God is trying to say something to us." And we have had that feeling within us since.
By mid-March of this year, the flood of flying saucer sightings had hit a new peak. Into many of these reports, there now crept a new and somewhat eerie tone. The feeling that these flying saucers were something out of this world, possibly interplanetary aircraft, sent from some distant celestial sphere to investigate what manner of life managed to exist here on Earth. In line with this, we went to Dr. Donald Menzel, professor of astrophysics at Harvard University and associate director of the famous Harvard Observatory, to find out just how feasible any such idea might be. Dr. Menzel had this to say.
Well, I suppose that anything is possible, but I consider it extremely unlikely.
Well, what could these flying bodies actually be, Dr. Menzel?
Sun shining from a very distant plane, shining so that you could see that there was an object there, but the plane so far away that you couldn't hear it. Weather balloon. You have the bright, round patch at fairly high altitude, sometimes three or four of them attached together. And then again, just pieces of paper carried aloft. When it gets up to 200 or 300 feet, you can't tell whether it's 100 feet or 1,000 or 10,000 feet away.
Prior to the middle of March, most observations, certainly all those which could be credited to reliable, sober sources, stated that the object seen was a good distance away, a distance that ranged from a few miles to 10 and 20. But on March 16th, a physician, a man who holds a private pilot's license, reported that he had seen some strange, unidentifiable type of flying body at close range. Dr. Craig Hunter of Berkeley Springs, West Virginia, had this experience.
We're going north on Route 153 from Clearfield, Pennsylvania, towards Penfield, Pennsylvania. And about 9 miles out of Clearfield, and I began to hear a hissing, whistling sort of a sound, something that was completely strange to me. And then I looked up into the sky, and coming from a southeasterly direction to a northwesterly direction was this flying disc, or for the want of a better name, a flying saucer. It was, I would say, around 150 feet around in circumference. And there was three distinct parts of it. There was an inner circle, a metal circle, which rotated around this inner circle, and an outside circle, which about one-third of the area on each side was covered with openings somewhat similar to an airliner opening. Now, this inner circle rotated anticlockwise very slowly, and it went over me, practically right over my head, and I would say it was traveling at a speed approximately 60 to 70 miles per hour. I would say that the plane was approximately 250 to 300 feet above me, not over 400 feet. It was of a dirty aluminum color, and I got a tendency to indicate the southern edge as sloping up, which would indicate to me that it was about 15 to 20 feet thick at the center. It would give you the idea that it was a rocket type of combustion, rather. It didn't give you the indication of a make and break, like a motor or anything like that. It was a continuous hissing, whistling sound. The conditions were very, very fine for observing it. I mean that it was just as clear as a bell, and I could distinctly see each and every detail as to the outline of it.
In order to check the whole question of design, to find out whether or not a saucer-like object such as the one described by Dr. Hunter could maintain itself in flight, according to the basic laws of aerodynamics, we call for the opinion of one of the nation's outstanding aeronautical engineers. Hall Hibbard is vice president and chief engineer of Lockheed Aircraft, and here is what he has to say over the beep recording telephone.
Well, my feeling is that that it is possible to build and fly something that looks like a saucer just from a technical standpoint, but I do not believe that there is such a thing at this time. I do not know of anything that would be considered in that category. I'm very familiar with pretty much what's going on in the way of research and development, and I know of nothing that would be considered as flying saucers or flying saucer material. you can make something that looks like a saucer fly, if anybody would ever want to do it. But I do not believe it would be possible with our present knowledge to have them make the speeds and everything that everybody has been talking about.
The flying saucer story came back into sharp focus on Monday of the present week. On that day, the United States News and World Report, a national news magazine, and Henry J. Taylor, a radio commentator, both came out with flat statements that flying saucers actually exist. Mr. Taylor said that there are two or more different objects that have been sighted and labeled flying saucers. One of these objects, the true flying saucer, according to Mr. Taylor, is a missile round in shape, varying in size from 20 inches to 250 feet in diameter. Some are guided, others are not. The U.S. News and World Report article mentions nothing about these objects. The magazine, however, describes a jet-propelled aircraft of revolutionary design that agrees in some details with Mr. Taylor's second secret aircraft, a piloted plane capable of high speeds and high maneuverability. Both accounts agree that the present models stem directly from the XF-5U-1, the so-called Flying Pancake, a small edition of which was built and flown in 1942. Last night, we put a special recording line into the home of Mr. Charles H. Zimmerman of the National Advisory Committee on Aeronautics, the man who originally designed the XF-5U-1. We asked him about the plane, whether it ever actually flew.
This aircraft never flew. The official designation of the aircraft was the XF-5U-1, which was to be a high-performance Navy fighter. However, a low-powered, lightly loaded version of this craft, called the V-173, made a large number of successful flights. I conceived the original idea for this craft back in 1933.
As a top plane designer, we asked Mr. Zimmerman to give us his opinion as to whether or not a plane could be built that could hover like a helicopter, then take off at almost supersonic speeds. He said,
"It would be possible using modern turboprop engines to build a machine of this type, which would be capable of hovering and of also flying at all forward speeds up to possibly 550 or 600 miles per hour.
To follow through on the problem of whether or not disc-shaped objects could actually fly, we got in touch with Mr. David C. Prince, vice president of the General Electric Company and chief of its General Engineering and Consulting Laboratory. Mr. Prince was having no part of flying saucers.
My thought is simply that the ability of some people to kid themselves is extraordinary. For instance, the effect of searchlights on clouds has been taken to be flying disks. Even radar evidence is not conclusive here because rain in the clouds would show up on a radar screen. The only saucer-shaped aircraft which we know has flown, and that only a few times, is a propeller-powered disk developed by NACA. As a matter of fact, a cigar-shaped craft with a single revolving wing, jet-powered, could be faster and certainly would be much more maneuverable. In flight, this plane might look like a disk because of the halo created by its rapidly revolving wing. Such a craft would have flight characteristics similar to a hummingbird's.
Late this afternoon, we tried to tote up the score. On one desk, we had a pile of clippings, news reports, recordings of eyewitness accounts of flying saucer observations. We had the Taylor broadcast, the U.S. News and World Report article. On another desk, we had our Project Saucer report, the transcripts of our conversations with leading scientists and engineers, who, to use a gentle phrase, discounted the possibility of any such thing as a flying saucer. On that desk, too, was the news ticker dispatch from the United States submarine base at Key West, Florida, a dispatch that quoted President Truman's press secretary, Charles Ross, as saying that President Truman has no knowledge of any secret project by this government that would give substance to the existence of such objects. Ross also said that both the Air Force and the Navy deny that such objects exist. We tried to add it all up. We admit that now, as before we started our case, we have no opinion. The figures just don't add up. So we went to the public. We went to the man and the woman on the street to see how they were reacting to this barrage of positive sightings and just as positive denials. We wondered how they felt. They told us.
Well, I think there's more to it than meets the eye, and I think it's more to it than what they're writing about.
Personally, I don't think such a thing exists. I don't see how it could.
I have a confidence that something on that order may exist. I lived in North Carolina in 1903 when the reporter for the New York World was fired for reporting that the Wright brothers flew.
Some say they're stars, some say they're enemy action, and all kinds of things, but I really don't know.
There must be something to it.
Purely imagination. I didn't believe it at first, but now I'm beginning to believe it.
Most of the thing is a flying saucer.
Well, I believe President Truman, like the rest of us, has a right to his own opinion.
And now, just in case all this has added to the celestial confusion about your heads, we've summarized the data we've been able to gather, sorted out the points of agreement and disagreement among those who claim to have seen flying saucers. Here is what we found. Nearly all these observers are in agreement on the color of the objects. It's a metallic color, they say, something like aluminum or silver. Almost everybody agrees the objects are generally disc-shaped, but with wide variations, sometimes balloon-like or resembling a giant rubber ball. Still others describe them as elongated cigar-shaped things. Speed of the saucers has been estimated at from 0 to 1,200 miles an hour. And when we get into the question of maneuverability, the observers seem not to be able to find the precise or adequate words. They say that the saucers hover, accelerate, and decelerate rapidly. They say that some of the objects flutter, oscillate, drift, whirl, or float. There seems to be no fixed pattern of flight in cases where more than one or two disks have been reported. But several persons have said that in group flights, one of the disks seems to be of a distinct color, indicating, possibly, that this off-colored disk was the monitor or the control disk for the others. A small percentage of the observers said the disks bore light, and in five cases, at points as far apart as Alabama and California, the viewers said the disks suddenly disappeared in flight. But when we get around to estimating altitudes at which the objects were sighted, we find that some observers say they saw them at 250 feet. Others guessed the disks were at 40,000 feet in the sky. While one observer estimated the number of disks seen at 100, nearly all thought the number was less than 10. And about half those who claimed to have seen the objects said they saw only single saucers. Well, these are the things men and women in various parts of the United States say they have seen in the sky. Men of science and high government officials cast a skeptical eye at these reported sightings of celestial phenomena. So far, in the course of this broadcast, there have been no reliable reports of the sighting of any new flying saucers. Frankly, we don't know the answer. We wonder, do you believe in flying saucers?
You've been listening to The Case of the Flying Saucer, a special report narrated by Edward R. Murrow. The Case of the Flying Saucer was based on extensive research collected with the aid of CBS-affiliated stations and CBS newsmen across the country. Portions of this broadcast were transcribed. This program was written by Irv Tunick, directed by John Dietz, and produced by Robert Bendick and Irving Gitlin.
The Case of the Flying Saucer, on Tuned to Yesterday, a CBS episode from April 7, 1950, a special one-off program for CBS newsman Edward R. Murrow. It would only be months later, in December of 1950, that he would begin what would be one of the most famous news magazines of the year, and pioneering at that, called Hear It Now. And about a year later, he would take the show to television for Edward R. Murrow's See It Now. This is an hour of science fiction on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levonier, and an emphasis on the fiction now, with an episode of X-1 called Death Wish, an NBC broadcast from October 10, 1957.
This is Nightline, your tie line to the world, and this is Walter O'Keefe. Tonight, a visit to worlds strangely different from ours, the world of the future, the world of X minus one. Now, here is the future, X minus one.
Countdown for blast off. X minus 5, 4, 3, 2, X minus 1, fire. From the far horizons of the unknown come tales of new dimensions in time and space. These are stories of the future, adventures in which you'll live in a million could-be years on a thousand maybe worlds. The National Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with Galaxy Science Fiction Magazine, presents
X minus one.
Tonight, Death Wish by Ned Lang. But first, hear this. During the theater season in New York, people flock from everywhere in the nation to see the latest Broadway plays. But very few of these people have ever been fortunate enough to experience the thrill and excitement backstage at one of Broadway's top musical comedies. Tomorrow night, Monitor invites you along as Don Russell goes backstage at the Broadway musical hit Simply Heavenly, introducing you to the cast, the author, listening to the songs from this fine musical show. It'll be an experience you won't soon forget. Then on Saturday, for sports enthusiasts, Army versus Notre Dame, and Monitor brings you this football classic direct from Municipal Stadium in Philadelphia. Add to these features Monitor's special coverage of the pomp, ceremony, and celebration during Queen Elizabeth's tour of Canada. Visits from celebrities like Mickey Rooney, Tennessee Williams, Tony Bennett, and Burl Ives, and you have some idea of the top variety of entertainment Monitor will bring you all weekend. So start your weekend right with Monitor on Friday night and stay with Monitor all weekend long over most of these same NBC radio stations. And now, X minus one, and tonight's story, Death Wish.
Fuel consumption normal.
We'll reach Point Able in 10 seconds from now. 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Cut.
Well, gentlemen, we're on our way to Mars. Now, Mr. Ratchett, give me a 30-second warning before we reach Point Baker.
Very well, Captain. Now, Mr. Watkins, what's the condition of your engines?
Don't you worry about my engines. The Deidre may be a cantankerous old crate, but she's good for another 5 or 10 round trips to Mars. You can lay to that.
Look at him, Captain. If anybody criticizes his engines, you can actually see that walrus mustache of his bristle.
Listen, Ratchick, I've had about enough of these personal remarks of yours. Stick to your navigation and let me alone.
Now, Watkins, let's not get into another of those arguments. Now, that's an order.
Aye, sir.
He had a reason for asking about your engines. I've made enough trips to Mars to know the way a ship should sound. There's something about this one. I don't know quite what.
There's nothing wrong with this ship, Captain Summers. I'll tell you something, though, every engineer worth his salt knows. There are just two kinds of equipment. The kind that fails bit by bit, and the kind that goes all at once. When something happens to the Deidre, you'll know it right away. You won't have to ask.
Well, maybe so. But I wonder if our cargo didn't shift on the takeoff. Mr. Ratchick, yes, would you be kind enough to check on it?
You bet, Captain, right away.
You worried about that new Ferenson computer we're carrying, Captain?
Oh, not worried exactly, but it's a responsibility. That thing is by far the largest, heaviest, most delicate piece of machinery ever transported in space.
It's an evil thing, with its blinking eyes and scheming brain. I'll be glad to get to Marsport and get it off the ship.
So will I, Watkins, but not quite for the same reason. I don't quite share your feelings about the personality of machines.
That's because you don't know anything about them, Captain. I do. And I don't like that computer thing back there in the hold.
All in order in the hold, boss. Cargo hasn't shifted.
All right, Mr. Ratchett. Maybe I'm borrowing trouble.
30 seconds to Point Baker, sir.
Very well. Strap yourselves on the acceleration couches again. You sure you don't read anything, Mr. Watkins?
Not a thing, sir. I'll vouch for every bit of equipment on the Deidre.
15 seconds to Point Baker.
Prepare for new acceleration.
Engines ready for firing, sir.
10, 9, 8.
We fire for 7, exactly 5 seconds 6, on reaching Point Baker 5, for maximum acceleration.
4, 3, 2, 1, fire!
That's 5. It didn't cut off.
We're over-firing. My fuel!
The course! We'll be off course!
The switch doesn't respond.
Emergency cutoff. Hit the emergency.
I can't move my arms. Acceleration.
Stop it. Stop the rockets.
My arms so heavy. If I could just reach the cutoff switch. There. What happened?
We're on emergency lights. We blew the generator. Of all the lousy things to happen.
Well, what was it?
Main firing circuit. It fused on us. Metal fatigue, I'd say. Must have been flawed for years.
When was it last checked out?
Well, it's a sealed unit, Captain. It's supposed to outlast the ship. Absolutely foolproof.
Unless it's flawed.
Now, don't go blaming it on me. Those circuits are supposed to be X-rayed, heat-treated, fluoroscoped. You just can't trust machinery.
How are we on fuel?
Not enough to push a kitty car down Main Street. If I could just get my hands on those factory inspectors...
Mr. Rancic, how does this affect our course?
I'm computing it now.
Well, hurry it up.
I'm working as fast as I can.
Mr. Watkins, can we fire those rockets on manual?
Sure we can, but we only have enough fuel for about a 3-second burst. It'll mean a crash landing.
We'll worry about that when we come to it. Well, Mr. Rancic?
This kills us, Captain. We're going to cross the orbit of Mars before Mars gets there.
How long?
Too long. Captain... We're flying out of the solar system at just under the speed of light.
You're listening to Death Wish, tonight's attraction on X-1. Now back to X-1 and Death Wish.
Look at him. Look at how he sits there staring at nothing. Here we are kiting off into space, and what do you do? We got a little fuel left. We can turn the ship, can't we? Look, you are a navigator, aren't you?
I am, Mr. Watkins. And for your information, if I plotted my courses the way you maintain your engines, we'd be plowing into the middle of Australia right now.
Why, you little company toady. At least I got my job honestly. Not by marrying the owner's daughter.
Why, you dirty old man.
Stop it, both of you. No more of this now. I give the orders here.
All right, then give some. Tell him to plot a return curve. This is life and death.
All the more reason for keeping our heads. Strachey, can you plot such a course?
The first thing I tried. On the fuel we got left, there isn't a chance. Best I could do would be a degree or two. That won't help.
What do you mean it won't? We'll turn back into the solar system.
Sure, but the best curve we can make will take us a few thousand years to complete.
What about a landfall on some other planet? Neptune, Uranus?
Impossible. In the first place, the right planet would have to be in the right place at the right time. And if it were, we'd need fuel, a lot of fuel, to get into a braking orbit. And if we could, who'd come and get us? No ship has gone past Mars yet.
Yeah, but maybe there'd be a chance, just a slim chance.
Maybe, but we can't swing it. Gentlemen, I'm afraid we'll have to kiss the solar system goodbye.
It just doesn't seem possible. Who would believe we're traveling at almost the speed of light? Look out the viewing port. You'd swear we were standing still in space.
Yeah, that's because there's no reference point, as you know. I assure you, we're traveling faster than any men have ever traveled.
What should we do, Captain?
I don't know, Watkins. I just don't know.
Our noble captain can't face the situation.
Of course I can face it. I can follow any course you plot. That's my only real responsibility. Now let's get a grip on ourselves. Mr. Rajic, suppose you raise Mars on the radio.
Aye, aye, sir. Deidre to Marsport. Deidre to Marsport. Urgent. Repeat, urgent. Come in, Marsport.
Marsport to Deidre. Read you. Over.
Emergency, Marsport. Firing mechanism jammed. Fuel almost totally expended. Acceleration, 15 seconds past safe maximum. Heading out of solar system. Request help. Over.
Can you turn the ship, Dietrich? Can you put it into any kind of an orbit? Over.
No fuel, Marsport. We can only turn a degree or two. Over.
Put your captain on, Dietrich. Over.
Captain Summers, Marsport. Over.
Captain, what do you propose to do?
Good Lord, man, that's what we're asking you.
What do you propose to do? I say, what do you propose to
What are they
do?
Saying?
I don't know. I couldn't catch it. Mr. Radjic, can't you get better reception?
We're rapidly running out of range, Captain. I'll give it all the gain I can get.
To Deidre. Marsport to Deidre. Can you read me?
There they are.
Shut up. Deidre, what can you do for us? Over.
Captain, we can't think of a thing. If you could swing into any sort of orbit.
We can't. I told you that.
Under the circumstances, Captain, you have the right to try anything at all. Anything, Captain.
Oh, that's nice of them.
What do they expect us to do, complain to the company?
Listen, Marsport. Marsport, do you still read me? Over.
Read you faintly. Go on, but hurry.
I can think of just one thing. We could bail out in spacesuits as near Mars as possible. The Diana is laying over there, isn't she? You could have her pick us up. Over.
Sorry, Captain. You're confused. If you left your ship, your momentum would not be affected. You and your crew would continue through space at the same rate as the ship. Over.
Of course. I wasn't thinking. I have it. Send the Diana out to intersect our course. Maybe we can find some way to transfer. My navigator will help you plot the intersection. Over.
Well, they've gone again.
Hello, Marsport. Hello, Marsport. Come in, Marsport.
I can't bring them in again.
You mean you can't do it? Why not? It is our only chance. Over.
Diana's laid up, having her engines overhauled.
How long before she can be spaceborne?
Too long. 3 weeks. Sorry, Captain. I wish we could think of something. But the only thing we can suggest...
What? I didn't get it. Reception's gone again, Captain. We're getting out of range. I don't know whether I can raise them again or not.
Well, try. Come on, maybe that suggestion
What can they suggest that we don't already know?
Even the static's getting weaker now.
If we only knew what they were going to say.
What's the difference? They didn't really think it would work anyhow.
Wait a minute. Wait. Maybe something's come... Hold it.
Suggest. Can you hear? Suggest, most unlikely, but try... Try calculator.
They're gone. For good this time.
I heard what he said. The calculator.
Does he mean the Farrenson computer in our hold?
Yes. Yes, I see what he meant. The Farrenson's a very advanced job. No one knows the limits of its potential. He suggests we present our problem to it.
Ah, that's ridiculous. The problem has no solution.
It doesn't seem to, but the big computers have solved other problems that seem to have no solution. Now, we can't lose anything by trying.
Yeah, not as long as we don't pin any hopes on
it. That's right. We don't dare hope. Mr. Watkins, I believe this is your department.
What's the use? You say don't hope, but both of you are hoping anyhow. You think the big electronic god is going to save your lives? Well, it's not.
Well, we have to try, man.
Who says we do? I wouldn't give it the satisfaction of turning us down.
Are you implying that machines think?
You bet I am, because they do. No, I'm not out of my head. Any engineer will tell you that a complex machine has a personality all its own. Do you know what that personality is like? It's cold, withdrawn, uncaring, unfeeling. A machine's only purpose is to frustrate desire and produce two problems for every one it solves. And do you know why a machine feels this way?
You're hysterical.
Oh, no, I'm not. A machine feels this way because it knows it's an unnatural creation in nature's domain. It wants to reach entropy and cease. It's a death wish. A mechanical death wish.
Gibberish. Watkins, are you going to hook up that computer?
Oh, sure, I'm human. I keep trying. I just wanted you to understand that there's no hope. I'll get it warmed up.
We better watch him.
He'll be all right.
Maybe. He's blaming the situation on a machine personality now, trying to absolve himself of guilt. It's his fault we're in this spot. An engineer is responsible for all equipment.
What's the good of blaming anybody?
None, I guess. Personally, I don't much care. This is as good a way to die as any. Better than most.
Don't talk like that.
Why not? Death in space is an appealing idea in certain ways. Imagine an entire spaceship for a tomb. And you have a certain choice in how you die. Thirst, hunger, heat, cold...
Shut up! Now that's an order!
This is your first real emergency, Captain. And you're responding like a stunned ox. Wake up! You can't live with joy. At least try to extract a little pleasure out of your dive.
Shut your mouth!
Well, gents, your little tin god's ready and waiting. Anybody care to make a burnt offering in front of it?
Have you given it the problem?
Most of it. You two have to punch up your own details. Position, elapsed time from maximum acceleration, water, oxygen, food.
All right. Come on, Ratchik.
Did you tell it we want to return to Earth alive?
Oh, yes. Yes, it loves that part. It'll get such pleasure out of rejecting the problem as unsolved. Oh, no. It won't say that. It'll say insufficient data.
And I'll punch up the rest of the information.
Insufficient data. You see the point? It hints a solution is possible, but just out of reach. A subtle torture. It can keep us hoping.
There. That's the complete picture. Now let's see what happens when I press this.
Now just keep your eye on that red light up there. If it goes on, it means a problem is rejected. Watch it now.
And if it solves it?
That's a little bell, sort of like a typewriter bell. But you won't hear it, don't worry.
Don't say that.
What's the matter, Rajik? Superstitious?
Oh, shut up. You two have to keep up that everlasting wrangling.
Well, not for long, Captain. We haven't much longer to live, Captain. Maybe that's good.
What's that?
A solution. It's found a solution.
That must be a mistake. There is no solution. It's fooling us, leading us on.
Now who's superstitious?
Here's the tape. The solution's on this.
What's it say? Come on, read it.
No, not me. You read it, Captain. I won't play its fiendish game.
Oh, I see. That's fine. That's just fine.
What does it say, for the love of heaven?
You figured a few thousand years to return to the solar system, Ratchik? Well, the computer agrees. 2,300 years, to be precise. Therefore, it has given us the formula for a longevity serum.
2,300 years? What are we supposed to do, hibernate?
Not at all. As a matter of fact, the serum does away quite neatly with the need for sleep. For 2,300 years, gentlemen, we three sit here in this little ship and look at each other. 2,300 years of that!
Yeah. Yeah, that's just the sort of thing a machine would do.
Fred Collins again, and I'll have another word for you about X-1 in a moment.
That how you feel, blue and miserable with a deep down cold? Listen.
Every second someone takes it for the miseries of a cold.
Millions more take bromoquinine.
Every second someone takes it for the miseries of a cold.
Bromoquinine.
More people have taken more bromoquinine cold tablets for more complete relief than any other cold tablet ever sold. You could use aspirin or cough syrups or nose drops all day and not get bromoquinine's relief. Bromoquinine works to relieve stopped up nose, body aches, fever, irregularity, the blues, and headache too. Yes, more complete relief for even virus colds. for bromoquinine is the only cold tablet sold with wonder-working quinine and five medicines health fortified with vitamin C. Remember,
every second someone takes it for the miseries of a cold.
Millions more take bromoquinine.
Get bromoquinine brand cold tablets.
You have just heard X-1 presented by the National Broadcasting Company in cooperation with Galaxy Science Fiction Magazine, which this month features You Were Right, Joe, by J.T. McIntosh, the story of a time traveler who, going into the future, hardly expected to encounter a Neanderthal man. Read it in Galaxy Magazine on your newsstand today. X-1 has brought you Death Wish, a story written by Ned Lang and adapted for radio by William Welch. Featured in our cast were Ralph Camargo as Watkins, Maurice Tarplin as Captain Summers, Walter Black as Ratchek, and Joseph Bell as the radioman. This is Fred Collins speaking. X-1 was directed by George Voutsas and is an NBC Radio Network production.
There's excitement in the air at night, and Nightline brings it to you. Hear Nightline with Walter O'Keefe next on most of these NBC stations.
X-1, pontooned to yesterday from October 10th, 1957 on NBC. And so closes this hour of science fiction on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's golden age. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levonier. Thanks for tuning in.